So I'm going to have you actually just turn to Genesis 11. Keep Acts 2 in the back of your minds. So Genesis 11, we're basically wrapping up the first 11 chapters of Genesis as we've kind of taken some time the last few months to look at these events in early history. And we spent some time looking at how the story of the Bible is the foundations that are established in those early chapters, and how that story becomes a way in which we understand what it is that's wrong with us, what it is, who it is that we are, kind of our identity, and what it is that we need, and what it is that God has promised to provide. So the story in Genesis 11 is probably familiar to everyone. I don't know if it gets more attention than the flood. My guess is that it doesn't get nearly as much attention as the flood. But it is the story of the Tower of Babel. You guys have all heard of this before, right? This is not new. So the interesting thing here is that, like I said last week, is that Genesis 11 actually chronologically takes place prior to Genesis 10. And we spent time last week looking at the genealogy in Genesis 10, which describes the nations that descended from Noah's sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and how they spread throughout the area, throughout the land. We have them up kind of in Asia Minor, all the way over to Greece, and we have all them all the way over on the northeastern side to Iran, down to Saudi Arabia and into Egypt, and all throughout that region, these nations spread. And kind of the refrain of Genesis 10 is the conclusion to each of those separate genealogies, which was, these people spread out, or they were dispersed according to their language, according to their clans, according to their nations. So we see that repeated throughout Genesis 10. And then we get to the beginning of Genesis 11, and we read this: now the whole earth had one language and the same words. So we know that there's a difference between what we just read and what we're reading in chapter 11. Genesis 11, the Tower of Babel, explains to us the reasons behind the dispersion and the creation of multiple languages. So Genesis 11 tells us, from that perspective, the events of the fall of the Tower of Babel, that God created languages, or he confused the languages of the people, and he scattered them or dispersed them throughout the land. Genesis 10, however, seems to put forth the positive perspective of the nations being fruitful. These are a fruitful people, but they're also a people that have been divided and split up. Genesis 11 tells us from the perspective of God's judgment that their fruitfulness and their dispersion was from God himself. God did this to them, causing them to scatter, confusing their languages. So let's read chapter 11, 1 through 9. Now the whole earth had one language and the same words. And as people migrated from the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. And they said to one another, come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone and bitumen for mortar. Then they said, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth. And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of man had built. And the Lord said, behold, they are one people, and they have all one language, and this is only the beginning of what they will do. And nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and there confuse their language, so that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord dispersed them from there over the face of all the earth, and they left off building the city. Therefore its name was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of all the earth. And from there, the Lord dispersed them over the face of all the earth. So let's kind of walk our way through this. The passage begins with a statement about the unity of mankind. So obviously, different picture than what we saw in chapter 10. Mankind is united in their language, and in their location. The whole earth had one language, the same word. So they had one lip, that's the word there for language, used throughout the passage, and they spoke the same. So they spoke the same words. So mankind is united in their language and their location. They migrated from the east, and they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. So where is Shinar? Does anybody know? Shinar is the plain between basically the Tigris and the Euphrates River, east of what we would know as the land of Canaan. This is the founding of the city Babylon. So remember Babylon from last week when we looked in Genesis 10. Who was the founder of the city in Babylon? Nimrod. Nimrod, the rebel, the mighty man, the mighty hunter. He established his kingdom. He set up his dominion, and it included Babylon and stretched all the way to Assyria, to Nineveh. So Nimrod is the founder of Babylon. He's not mentioned in Genesis 11, but we know that this is the origins of the city of Babylon. So they are now migrating to the east to go to Shinar, and they are going to settle there. So why are they there? Well, they're there to build a city, to build a tower. They actually create a new technology, so they are able to make bricks, and they are able to somehow bake the bricks to create a hardened building material. It's interesting here, there's so much repetition in the passage that they're literally bricking bricks, and they're burning them with burning. So this is weird repetition that the author uses here to tell us what they're actually doing here. They're making bricks. So interestingly, an interesting archaeological fact apparently is that brick making was common in Babylon, but it wasn't common in the land of Canaan. So in the promised land, the land of Canaan, they didn't use bricks or make bricks to build buildings. They used stone. Apparently like a more readily available building material in the land of Canaan that wasn't available in Babylon. But here we have them making bricks, so they're creating a technology that's going to allow them to build a city and a tower. They take clay or dirt or whatever it might be and mix it with straw and bake it in an oven or in the hot summer sun, and they create these bricks, and that gets them thinking about what they can do with the bricks. And what they can do with the bricks is to make a city and a tower. They have apparently some bitumen, which is like a tar-like substance, apparently, or an asphalt-like substance, people say. You'll see this account later on in Genesis when Abram goes to war against the kings of Babylon, the kings of Sodom, and there's people who fall into the bitumen pits. So if you're familiar with that story, there's apparently some more readily available natural resources that they can use to kind of glue or hold these bricks together that they're making. So they have the building materials, they have the ingenuity, they have the technology, they want to put it to use. They have brick for stone and bitumen for mortar. They build the bricks and they come up with the idea to build for themselves a city and a tower. So they say to themselves, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth. So this verse, verse 4, helps us to understand what is motivating them and what their goals are in building this city. Why is it that the people decide to stay together, gather together, under the same language and the same location, to create a technology for them to build a city and a tower? Why are they doing that? Because they want to reach the heavens, because they want to make their name great, and because they don't want to be scattered. They don't want to be dispersed. So humanity now is united in this purpose. They've come together in Shinar, in Babylon, to create a city for themselves, to make a name for themselves, to reach into the heavens, so that they will not be dispersed over the face of the whole earth. So That is their desire. Those are their goals. Those are their intentions. But what does it actually mean? What are they trying to accomplish? Are they literally thinking that they can build a tower big enough to reach into the heavens? Well, probably not. At least not in the way that we think of it. Conceptually, not in the way that we understand the relationship between the land, the earth, and the heavens, the sky. Not the way that we think of it, but according to their understanding of the world, this is what they're trying to do. They want to bridge the gap between the land, the earth, and the heavens. They want to bridge the gap between where man lives and where God lives, where God resides. They want to create a way in which they can attain to the heavenly realm and yet still be earth brick-making people. So interestingly, there is actually a word for this temple or this tower. Most likely this was a ziggurat. If you're familiar with a ziggurat, it was like a step-layered temple, not temple, pyramid-shaped building that had stairs leading up to the top and stairs surrounding the outside of it so that people can ascend into the heavens. And there is a name for this particular temple, for this particular ziggurat in Babylon called the Entamaki or something like that. And you can actually look this up online. Sorry, I don't know how to spell it. But you can look it up online and you can see research that's been made about the foundation of this ziggurat, a famous ziggurat. And there's obviously lots of allusions to the biblical text when you do that. And some people say that this becomes the background for the inspiration of the biblical story of the Tower of Babel. What happens in this temple, basically in the ziggurat, it becomes a temple for the gods, for the Babylonian god Marduk. So Marduk was the Babylonian god that defeated the sea, the Tiamat, and the Babylonian understanding of the early origins of the universe. And he sets up his kingdom, and his people build him a ziggurat and place a temple for him to dwell on at the top of the ziggurat. So it literally is referred to in the Enuma Elish as a ziggurat with a temple on top, the top of which is in the heavens. So there's clearly here another occasion in the early chapters of Genesis in which the biblical authors are responding to a pagan belief system. And they're saying, no, this is not actually the... Your version of the story is not actually the correct version of the story. Let me tell you what that is. So this is a polemic against the pagan beliefs. Just like we saw in Genesis 1, just like we saw in the flood story, just like we saw in the fall of man. Those are all responses to pagan beliefs. So, in the Babylonian version of the story, they're creating a temple. They're creating a tower and placing a temple upon it so that the gods can dwell among the people. They're creating a way for them to be in contact with the gods, to serve the gods in a high place. So what is the purpose then of the biblical story? Well, look at it again. They want to make a name for themselves. What are they longing for? What is their goal? Their goal is fame, notoriety. They want to become legends. In their arrogance, they want to become famous. They want an immortal name. A name that actually transcends their dust-like life. Their 80 years. A name that actually continues on from generation to generation to generation. They want to build something big enough so that everybody can see it and observe it and know that you guys, they were the awesome people who built such a magnificent tower. In one sense, they want to be like Nimrod, right? Nimrod became famous because he was a mighty hunter. Nimrod, we know Nimrod's name because he established cities and he built a dominion, but he was a violent despot. So they are just like their founder. They want to build a name for themselves. They want to build a tower that reaches into the heavens. In one sense, they want to be able to transcend the boundaries that God has placed upon them. So man, it's interesting that God calls them the children of man in verse 5. The children of man, so the sons, literally the sons of Adam. So the sons of the dust man, Adam, who was made from the Adama, the sons of the dust man want to ascend into the heavens. They want to build a tower that places them up into the skies. So they're seeking not just a name for themselves, a prideful, arrogant, boastful name for themselves, but they're seeking glory. They're seeking immortality. They're seeking transcendence. And they want to avoid, their fear is being scattered. They want to avoid being dispersed over the whole earth. So that's what they want. And it doesn't take much for us to reflect upon that and thinking about, okay, in our day and age, when you go to a city, what is it that you see? So I recently went to Chicago in June for a little conference, and we got to walk around downtown Chicago, and it's fascinating. Like, it blows my mind. I'm astonished to see how the scale of these buildings, right? So you're used to going downtown Spokane, and you have like a 15-story building, and that's impressive. But you go downtown Chicago, and the buildings seem to actually stretch into the sky. And sometimes they build a building so magnificent and so high, they put somebody's name on it, and it says something like Trump. So yeah, we got to see Trump Tower, and it was pretty cool. I was impressed. But what is that? It's a legacy. It's building something and putting your name upon it. It's building something great and magnificent in the eyes of men, but it's stamping your name upon it, saying, look what I've done. Look what I've been able to accomplish. They're making a name for themselves. They're seeking immortality. So the Sears Tower and Eisenhower, I think that's another big one down there, or the Hancock Building, whatever it is. They're magnificent buildings, astonishing in ingenuity. Some of them have holes, like floors are wide open so that when the wind comes in the windy city, they can sway and they can absorb all the wind blows and all that kind of stuff. It's just phenomenal to see that. But they're using technology to make a name for themselves, to exalt themselves, to lift themselves up. Now, cities in the ancient days, it's always kind of viewed from a negative perspective. I think I mentioned this last week, but when we thought about cities, who was the first one to build a city in the early chapters of Genesis? It's Cain. So Cain builds a city, and he names the city after his son. So that's significant. He's creating a city. When God cast him out east of Eden, he sent him out further east. He sent him out as a hopeless wanderer, as a migrant, as a nomad. Cain decides to establish his roots. He builds a city to protect himself from those who would seek his life, and he names a city after his own son. So Cain is like a picture, like a microcosm of the Tower of Babel. What Cain does as an individual, the nation under one language does as a whole. I think that's another indicator here. There's this idea of being protected. They're fearing being scattered, separated, dispersed over the face of the earth, but they want their own protection. So the people have become self-sufficient. They become arrogant, thinking that they can accomplish this magnificent thing. They become religious, and they're seeking of a heavenly realm, and they're disobedient. God commissioned them to be fruitful, to multiply, and to fill the earth. And they're saying, no, we'd just rather stay put. We would just rather be together and be here. We would rather just build for ourselves a city and make our name great and establish a realm that inhabits all of the earth. That's what they're seeking. So, the center of the story. The center of the story is verse 5. The Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of man had built. So God now comes. He comes and he is like the building inspector, right? He comes and he's going to see what it is that man has done. What you have prior to this is you have verse 1 kind of as in a summary of their location and language. then you have them giving two speeches about what they're going to do. And then in verse 5, you have God, actually, so let me skip. Verse 9, you have a summary of what took place as a result of God's assessment. Prior to that, you have two speeches in which God declares what he's going to do. And then you have the center of this, which is verse 5. God comes down and he assesses what mankind has done, what the children of man had built. So there is something that is a little bit ironic about this. Remember, the purpose in building the tower is to ascend into the heavens, to build a tower big enough so that the top of it reaches into the heavens, where God is. And yet, God still has to come down. God still has to descend to see what the children of man had built. So there's kind of this this way in which you can mock somebody in sports. When you score a point or a goal over them, you could do this, which is kind of symbolizing that they're too small. So this is God actually saying to the people of Shinar, they're too small. Let me see this little tower that they've made. God comes down to see this, and this anticipates God's coming down throughout the Bible. He comes down. Man cannot build something big enough to ascend into the heavens. God must come down. That's the point. God comes down, and he comes down to see the city and the tower that the children of man had built. Now, why is this significant? Because it doesn't matter how much or how ingenious we become or how brilliant we think that we are, we still can't ascend into the heavens. We still can't get there. God must come here. And it tells us that God is one who comes here. God comes to us, right? God comes to us. He descends, or he condescends and comes to us. But notice what it is that the Lord is doing. He's going down. He's coming down to see what the people had built. And why is that significant? Well, if you've been with us in the early chapters of Genesis, we've seen that this is something that is repeated throughout these stories. God sees. He sees what he has made, and he declares it to be good. He sees the wickedness of man, and he brings a flood. He sees the rainbow, and he remembers his covenant. And on the opposite side of that, when we read the fall narratives, what is it that man does? Man sees the fruit and takes it and eats it. Man sees the daughters of men, that they're beautiful, and they take them and they marry them. Ham sees the nakedness of Noah, but Shem and Japheth don't look upon their father's nakedness, and they cover him up so that it is not seen. So what we're seeing here is the whole theme. One occasion in which we have the fall narrative in the garden, one occasion in which we have the fall narrative prior to the flood, and the fall narrative after the flood with Noah and his sons. Here, this is another fall narrative. This is another collapse. This is another fall of humanity. God comes to see what they've done. He comes to evaluate. What is it that they've been able to do? What is it that they've done? He comes to pronounce his judicial sentence. So what does he say? Well, we have two sayings. One that demonstrates the ability of man, if you want to say it that way. And then one that demonstrates God's just judgment upon them. So first saying, the Lord said, "Behold, they are one people. They are a united group of people. They have one language, one lip. And this is only the beginning of what they will do. And nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible for them." So God's assessment then is that in some sense he seems to be impressed by what mankind can do. Like, man, I didn't know that so many people could come together and create a new technology and build something as impressive as this. Even though he descends to see it, God is seemingly impressed with what mankind can do. He wonders what it is that they can do if they remain together. He seems to imply that they can do whatever they set their minds to, that nothing is outside of their grasp. Nothing is impossible for them. So their unity, their togetherness, their language, being able to communicate with one another, their ingenuity, their creativeness, their design, their plans, it does seem to be unlimited. They have unlimited potential. Now, it's interesting that that seems to echo God's words after the fall of the man and the woman in the garden. What did God say at the end of Genesis 3? After the man and the woman ate the fruit and God pronounced his judicial sentence upon them, he says, "Behold, man has become like one of us in knowing good and evil. Now, lest he reach out his hand and take also of the tree of life and eat and live forever, therefore the Lord God sent him out from the Garden of Eden." So he exiled him. He sent them out to the east. What we have here is similar to that. The Lord sees what man can do, not simply what they've become, but what they can do if they stay united. So, he decides, in light of man's seemingly unlimited potential, he decides to render his judgment. Verse 7, "Come, let us go down and there confuse their language so that they may not understand one another's speech." So God is going to come. He's going to mix or confuse. He's going to muddle their languages so that they may not understand one another. And that's going to result then in their dispersion and their scattering. Now, it's an interesting tactic, right? I mean, interesting on the one hand that God chooses to do this and not something else. But he chooses to confuse their languages, create probably a vast variety of different languages and dialects, and cause them to be dispersed as a result. So what's significant about that? Well, just think for a moment, if we all came together and Tricity spoke Latin and Angelica spoke Russian and Michaela spoke Spanish and Mark spoke Greek and Ingrid spoke German, and we all came together speaking those languages, would we be able to accomplish much together? Unless there was an interpreter, we wouldn't be able to accomplish much together. So it seems to be then a tactic in which God can cause division as a result of confusing their language, confusing their lips, giving them different lips to speak in a way of saying. So that's God's judgment. So God renders his judgment. He confuses their language. And verse 8 tells us that they were dispersed from there over the face of all the earth, and they left off building the city. That's probably my favorite part. So thinking about abandoned building projects. Like, here we have probably the most significant historical abandoned building project in the world. Here they are striving to make a name for themselves, striving to do something to make them seem great, to ascend into the heavens, and they get halfway done. God confuses their language, and then they have to leave off building the rest of the project. It's simply there standing unfinished in ruins, as a testimony to God's judgment, as a monument to God's justice. They were disobedient, they were apostates, they were exalting themselves, and God brings them low, and he leaves the building there to remind them that he rendered his judgment and confused their tongues and dispersed them over the face of the earth. So they had intended the building to be a monument to their greatness. God, ironically, judges them and leaves the building there to be a testimony of his justice. Verse 9 gives us the summary. Therefore, its name was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of all the earth. You have probably that footnote there on the word confused, which is going to tell you something like this word, it sounds similar to the word Babel. Babel means confusion. The word translated confused is Balel. So God called Babel confusion. He called the tower Babel, meaning confusion, because it was there that God confused the language of the people. So one author, Robert Alterd, in his translation, puts it this way. Therefore it is called Babel, for there the Lord made the language of all the earth Babel. So that's the interesting thing about the word Babel. Is it's a word that sounds like how it's spelled, right? There's, I think, a technical word for that. You grammarians probably know what that word is. But it's spelled the way that it sounds. Babel. So Babel is called Babel because there the Lord babbled their language. And that's kind of the play on words that's being used in the passage. Babel becomes Babylon. Of course, that arch enemy of Israel. But it's named that, not from the perspective that they were seeking to want for themselves, to establish their own names, to create for themselves a tower that transcends into the heavens, but it's there named that way because God confused their language. Again, just like the abandoned building project, the name of that place became known because God confused their language. So that's the thing. They wanted a great name. They wanted to make a name for themselves. Well, they got a name. And the name was Babel. The name was confusion. It wasn't, oh, exalted ones whose tower was in the tops of the heavens, who reached the tops of the heavens. No, it was confusion. So God renders his judgment upon the arrogant people, and he names them, he leaves the monument to his justice, and he names them Babel, and that's how they're known throughout all of history. It just seems like that would be something God would do. God does stuff like that, stuff that is kind of ironic twists. So he can confound the wisdom of the wise by doing something seemingly foolish, by crucifying his son. And he can humble the exalted city of Babel and call it confusion. I have a long quote here from an older commentator that sums up this point very well. This is from Umberto Casuto. You children of Babylon, you called your city Babel in Akkadian Babylon, which means gate of the god or gate of the gods. So they're thinking of their tower then in terms of an entryway, an entry place for man to transcend to heaven and for gods to come down to men. You called it Babel, your tower you designated house of the foundation of heaven and earth, which is the word, the name of their ziggurat, which was the entomachy. You desired that the top of your tower should be in heaven. You did not understand that even if you were to raise the summit of your ziggurat ever so high, you would not be nearer to him than when you stand upon the ground. Nor did you comprehend that he who in truth dwells in heaven, if he wishes to take a closer look at your lofty tower, must needs come down. Your intention was to build for yourself the gigantic city that would contain all mankind, and you forgot that it was God's will to fill the whole earth with human settlements, and that God's plan would surely be realized. You were proud of your power, but you should have known that it was forbidden to man to exalt himself, for only the Lord is truly exalted. And the pride of man is regarded by him as iniquity that leads to his downfall and degradation, a punishment befitting the crime. On account of this, your dominion was shattered and your families were scattered over the face of the whole earth. Behold, how fitting is the name that you have given to your city. It is true that in your language it expresses glory and pride, but in our idiom it sounds as though it connoted confusion. The confusion of tongues heard therein, which caused its destruction and the dispersion of its inhabitants in every direction. That's a great summary of the passage. So what do we glean from this? Tower of Babel, this ancient story about God confusing the languages of the people. I think one thing that becomes patently clear is that the people were united in their desire to exalt themselves. Unity is not an end in itself. Unity is not an end in itself. People can be united for good things. They can be united upon God glorifying things. They can be united upon truth and beauty and goodness. But unity is not an end in itself. We can't simply pursue unity or think that we can pursue unity at the expense of truth. You're going to hear a lot of that. Unity. Democracy. All these powerful trigger words. You're going to hear a lot of that. Even thinking about the Olympics, which is kind of a prime example then of people seeking their own glory. By and large, not in all circumstances. That's why it's so refreshing to hear Christian athletes who are doing something for the glory of God and what God accomplishes through them, even though they devote themselves to training for years and years and years from childhood on. Every aspect of their life is organized around achieving these goals. They do so for God's glory, not to make their names immortal, but they do so for God's glory. But there is a lot of them achieving or seeking to attain their own immortality. That their own great names. It is hard. It's just cool to see kind of the national perspective on that. To see nations and to count the medals, and apparently we're still beating China, or at least we tied China in the gold medal race, whatever it might be, which is exciting. You know, that's awesome. But that's not the point of it. People can be united for those purposes, to achieve their own greatness, to make themselves great or their nations great. But if it's at the expense of truth, then it's not a unity worth pursuing. And ultimately, it's a unity that will fail, that will be fractured. Because truth is what binds us together. Truth is what creates unity. Another thing to think about is this whole idea of exalting ourselves. I think the whole purpose of God is to create, at least in these early chapters, is to create image bearers. So those who reflect their God, the God who has made them, who bring His image out and fill the earth with His image bearers, to exalt, not the image bearers, but to exalt the one who created them in His image. The whole purpose of the creation account is to exalt the one true, holy, just, loving God, the Creator God. By and large, looking at a big picture, the whole purpose of Genesis 1 through 11 is God's purposes in His creation and judgment and His covenant promises is to exalt His name. He is the true God. Your stories, to the pagans, are saying your stories are not correct. They have elements of truth in them, but they're just simply rip-offs. They're facades. It's artificial what they're creating. This is the true God who creates by His word. The true God who organizes the chaos. The true God who makes man in His image. The true God who blesses man with the covenant of marriage. The true God who brings judgment down upon men when they disobey Him and rebel against Him. This is the true God. He is the one who deserves to be exalted. It's His name that we're seeking to make great, or to recognize as great, or to portray as great. We're seeking to exalt His name. That's the purpose of it. In one sense, there's also a national warning, right? Here is a people united together in one location around a central purpose to make their name great. And what does God do? God brings judgment and He scatters them. That would be just like something God would do. A warning to Israel that if they're not united around the right things, that God is going to bring judgment and He's going to scatter them, which is what we see eventually happening to them. They are scattered out among the nations. Something that we could see God perhaps doing to us. Here we are at the United States. Well, wouldn't it be something just like something God would do if he brought division among these so-called United States? Again, the union, unless it's a union based in truth, is not going to last. So the interesting thing here is that God judges these people. He gives them a name. That's a twist upon their name that they were seeking. And he confuses their languages. So I think I mentioned this last week. It's not really the end of the story. It's just simply another account of the fall, just with different colors, different participants. There's an interesting word that's used here. The word for name, like I mentioned last week, is the name Shem, or the word Shem, which just so happens to be one of Noah's descendants, his sons, named Shem. So what are you going to name your son? I'm going to name him Name. So Shem was named Name. And it's Shem that Noah blesses. Actually, he blesses the God of Shem, Yahweh, after his fall. And it's Shem's line, who is last in Genesis 10. And we noted that there was a division that took place among his descendants between Peleg and Joktan. And then we have another genealogy of Shem at the end of Genesis 11. And that genealogy follows through Peleg, and it ends in Terah. Terah, verse 26, lived 70 years. He fathered Abram, Nahor, and Haran. So what happens then is that, in one sense, the people want to make a Shem for themselves. The people are out there to make their name great, to exalt their Shem, and God gives them a name, and the name is Babel. Why does God do that? Because he has another name in mind. He has another Shem that he is working out his plans and his purposes through. Shem gets us from Noah to Abram. And then what does God promise Abram? He promises in chapter 12, verse 2, that he would make his name great. So here's the contrast. Babel exalts itself to make their name great, to make for themselves an exalted name. But God's plan is to exalt someone else from the line of Shem. And his exaltation will be this one dude from Babylon, from Ur of the Chaldees. He'll call him out and he will make his name great. He will exalt the name of Abraham. So the primeval history then of Genesis 1 through 11 actually sets us up perfectly for beginning the patriarchal history with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So that God's name will be exalted in Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. One more thing. The unification or reunification of the peoples. So we leave Genesis 11 in the Tower of Babel with a people speaking different languages and being dispersed over the face of the land. So that is in one sense, that is the reality in which Israel lives. Here are the nations that surrounded Israel during their whole time of existence. These are the people, these are the nations that speak different languages, have different customs, worship different gods than you. Their mission was to be a light to the nations. And they failed in that. So eventually, got to the point in which God decided to do something about it himself. And what did he do? He came down again. He condescended. He came from heaven to earth. And what he manifested his glory among the nations. So he was a light to the Gentiles. In the incarnation, in the person of Jesus, God came in the flesh. He became one of us. As the offspring of Abraham, he became the promised seed who would bring blessing to the nations, all the families of the earth, as God promised Abraham in Genesis 12:3. All those families that we see dispersed and scattered and spread out across the face of the land, speaking all of their different languages, they would all be blessed in Abraham's offspring, in his offspring that ultimately is fulfilled in Jesus. He is the offspring of Abraham that brings God's blessings back upon the nations that have been dispersed. But that still doesn't solve the language problem. So what do we see happening then? In Pentecost, we see Jesus, the crucified, risen, exalted Lord, ascend into the heavens, give out the promise of the Father. He pours out His Spirit upon those who trust in Him, upon His disciples. They receive His Spirit, and the Spirit descends upon them like tongues on fire, flaming tongues. They descend upon them like flaming tongues, and they begin to exalt and praise and glorify God in a multitude of languages. So we're given a glimpse then of those who heard, and from those who heard, they were gathered together, Jews and proselytes, so converts to Judaism and Jews who had been scattered across the face of the earth in Jerusalem to celebrate Pentecost. They're there, and they see this take place, and they hear God being glorified in their own tongues. It's the beginning of what God would do to exalt His name among those that have been scattered and upon the languages that have been confused. Through the Spirit, through the outpouring of the Spirit, God is in one sense reversing the curse of Babel. God is bringing about the exaltation of His name among a group of people that have been scattered but now gathered together in one place through His Spirit. Jesus is restoring the divisions that take place, and in the prophecy of Zephaniah, He's creating a people who speak a purified speech. God gathers them. On the cover of your bulletin, from beyond the rivers of Cush. Remember, Cush is in Egypt. The worshippers, the daughter of His dispersed ones, they shall bring His offerings. On that day you shall not be put to shame because of the deeds by which you have rebelled against Me. For then I will remove from your midst your proudly exultant ones, and you shall no longer be haughty in My holy mountain. I will leave in your midst the people who are humble and lowly. They shall seek refuge in the name of the Lord. Those who are left in Israel, they shall do no injustice and speak no lies, nor shall they be found in their mouth a deceitful tongue. They shall graze and lie down, and none shall make them afraid. So what does God do? He changes the speech of the peoples to a pure speech. Not that they all speak the same language, but they all come together and glorify God as they humble themselves before Him. So this is the way in which God seeks to reverse the curse of Babel. To bring people together in the name of His Son, the name that is the greatest name, the name above all names. He brings the people together to worship His Son, to exalt His name, to glorify Him, and together they do so in unity. God brings about a gathering of those that have been dispersed through the blood of Jesus and the power of His Spirit. So when we think then about the goals that we set forth, the goals of unity or the goals of exalting the name of God, we do so knowing that unless God is the one who is doing it through us, we're going to fail in that attempt. We can't do that on our own. We can't build a house unless the Lord builds it. We just simply build in vain. We need God to bring us together and exalt His holy name. We need Him to purify our speech so that it's not deceitful, so that it's truthful, so that it speaks truth and love. And that's what God is accomplishing through His Son. Let's pray.